in the real time.
We had to cross the railway line. It was a single track railway line running from Caffa, which is on the banks of the River Irrawaddy, up to, and the track ran into Indore. And we were about to go across this line when, this was dark, by the way, remembering, we could hear a train chuffing and chugging its way along this railway line. Now, I don't think I've seen 400 or 500 men disappear into jungle so quickly as our column did, so that we were not seen, because we were straddled across the line, and we did not want to be seen, because of the ambush that had gone on. We were a bit disjointed and not sufficiently organised to really get into another melee with them at that particular time. And one of the occasions was that on crossing this line, we were carrying one of the men who had an accident with a Sten gun, and we'd been carrying him for 3 or 4 days where he'd fractured his thigh, and he was sitting on a pony, and he was just literally yanked off of that pony unceremoniously and hauled into the jungle. But the boy never uttered a word, not a word of moan or groan. He really did take it very well. But however, we laid there and we just literally looked at this train loaded with Japs, and the train driver, you could see, burning the wood and getting the train, and they were chug-chugging right the way up into Indore. And as the train disappeared into Indore, or going into Indore, and it quietened down, we decided that we'd commence recrossing. And at that time, at that very moment, some Japanese bloke boloed out, whoever he was, some sort of challenge. But we didn't answer it. We just sort of remained quiet and eventually continued the journey into the hills, and made our way back towards Aberdeen. One of the interesting little stories about the journey back was when we lost one or two chaps. We'd halted in the hills, in jungle, and it was decided we wanted some water. And we went searching for it, found it, and most of us were able to find the way back, but two chaps just literally disappeared. And nobody knew where they went, what happened to them, and they were never heard of or seen again, ever. So it just shows you how easy it was to become lost. But we did eventually succeed in getting back to Aberdeen.
What was the situation now when you...
Well, when we got back, obviously, the authorities began to realise that we may be somewhere near towards the end of our tether physically. And if you're not physically fit and you're worn down, you're not going to be terribly efficient in any fight that you might get into from then on. But the brigadier decided, this Brigadier Ferguson, decided that he wanted one more effort made on Indore to see if we could have some effect. In the meantime, while all this happened to 21 column, 22 column had been more successful, and they had successfully blown up a road bridge on the Banmork Indore road.
Probably best not to go into those since you work with them.
Yes, that's right. I'm just mentioning it. Yes, but we just eventually finished back into Aberdeen, and it was decided to give us 2 or 3 days rest and to re-equip from supplies that might have been there, which we did, and we had 2 or 3 days rest. And then there was a change in tactics a little bit for the next part of the operation. it was decided that 21 and 22 columns would combine and attack the airstrips in Indore. And to do that, they decided also that it was wrong to send in the close quarter fighting lads with packs and everything on their backs. It rather did impede the mobility, which is obvious, isn't it? So what we did is we after 2 or 3 days rest, we were given the necessary orders and we set off again from Aberdeen on about a 2 day march, I think it would have been, about 2 or 3 days, till we got to what was termed a safe area, where the soft part of the column was left. That would be like me, rear column headquarters, and all the heavier baggage and the packs of the men who were going to go in and do the attack onto the airstrip. And so we did that, and we laid up there for a couple of days in this safe area while the infantry side of the column went in, and they did do a rather more successful attack. But when they went in there, I think they didn't find anything at all. The airstrip had been evacuated, and they had the Japs had gone to cover somewhere. I don't know where, but they weren't there when eventually our lads went in. One of the main interesting things about that was that we had a Royal Air Force officer with us who was an expert on wireless ground-to-air communication, and he had with him a team of Air Force chaps, a corporal, a couple of corporals, whatever, who operated these powerful long-distance radios, wireless sets. Can't remember what the names, but they were big, and they were very good at Morse, and sending all signals went out under Morse code. And he, whilst he was travelling with one of the companies, I think it was the recce column, discovered a number of Jap hutments in the jungle and around the fringes of indoor airstrip. And when he got back to the column, he decided that he went and approached the brigadier and said, could they fly him back to India? And he would bring in and lead in a bombing assault on this particular area. And this he did. He flew in, guided them, and some Mitchell bombers flown by the American Air Force came in. And we actually witnessed this from the top of a hill, where they literally plastered the place and blew quite a bit of the supplies and ammunition that the Japs had stored around there. So I suppose in the end some of the communications were disrupted, which we'd been sent in to do.
What happened to you next?
At the conclusion of that exercise, once again... No, beg your pardon. At the conclusion of that exercise, the brigadier and the higher authorities back in India had come to the conclusion that 16th Infantry Brigade, in particular, had shot their bolt. And we'd been operating since very early February and marching continuously day in and day out, and this was about the 5th of May, if I can remember the date almost exactly, about then. And the commanding officer received instructions that we were to make our way to a place called Broadway, which was another one of these strongholds that had been established, where we were to be picked up by aircraft and flown out back to India. This took the best part of another 5 or 6 days journey, again over pretty mountainous terrain, and We do remember passing extremely close to a place called the Morlu Roadblock, which another brigadier had put up a tremendous performance. His name was Mad
Calvert.
Yes, that's right. Mad
Michael Calvert.
Michael Calvert. That's right, Brigadier Calvert. He commanded. Was it 77 Brigade? No.
77 Column.
No, he was a brigade commander. I forget his command.
It's all right, isn't it?
But anyway, he definitely took a great toll of the Japanese at that particular bloke, the Hinu Roadblock. But it wasn't our battle. But we passed close enough to it to not to want to be involved, so to speak. And we eventually arrived at Broadway. And there we were given unrestricted use of the food supplies that had been accumulated there for such occasions, and resupplying. And the battalion was flown out in Dakotas, or the column was flown out in Dakota aircraft, as and when they became available over the next two or three days. And that ended our Burma effort.
Was that the end of operations for you in the war?
Yes. From my point of view, it was. And I don't know about a lot of the other lads, but when we flew out from Burma and eventually arrived at a place called Camilla. And
what state were you in?
I think we were all pretty tired and run down, quite honestly. We were all sporting beards of some form or another. Because of the monotonous food supply that we'd had and all that sort of thing, we weren't in too good a shape. But at the same time, given the conditions, I suppose not too bad, really. Tired, obviously. It was a nerve-wracking little campaign, in as much that, on reflection, one very rarely spoke above a whisper. There was no bawling and shouting, for instance. It was a very much a quiet sort of speaking voice, nothing much louder than what I'm saying now to one another. That, again, for obvious reasons. And the uncertainty all the time. Were you going to be pounced on before you could pounce on them? Or in simple language, were you going to be ambushed or not?
Can we jump ahead in your career to Berlin? Because I think you were there in Germany at the time of the Berlin airlift.
That's right, yes, yes.
Can you tell me your personal memories of that, please?
Yes, I think Berlin... when we first got there, we moved into a place called the Olympic Stadium. I was a colour sergeant still at that time, colour sergeant of B Company then, and I don't think there was anything extraordinarily outstanding from my point of view, except that, again, there was always this degree of uncertainty that was reigning because of the blockade situation. We lived a pretty Spartan sort of life. Rations were pretty basic, although I don't think we can say we were ever hungry. Entertainment at night was a little bit restricted because of the lighting restrictions. But other than that, I don't think we did too badly, really.
How did you get on with the Germans themselves, the civilians?
Rhys, I think, again, given the amount of time that had elapsed since the end of the war, which wasn't very long, really, was it? The fact that we'd had this terrible war with them, basically reasonably friendly.
Did you ever come across any hostility?
Not personally, no. I think one might have detected here and there a little bit of, what would you call it, resentment from the odd one or two that one spoke to. For instance, we had a maid who was in official maid who was paid for by the civilian authorities. And she was inclined to be a little truculent at times, in her manner, but I think that's about the only thing I could really say about it.
Did any of them say, why don't you go home?
Not to me, no, I don't think they dare say that to anybody, quite honestly. They might have done, but I don't think they did.
How did the Berlin airlift affect you?
The Berlin, it didn't affect us in as much that it upset us in our daily routine, but it was an experience to see, a great experience to see, because it went on day and night, day in and day out, week in and week out, as you know, for what, the best part of 18 months, was it? I think it went on. It was like looking at a convoy on the road. You looked up into the air and you could see Dakotas and all types of cargo-carrying aircraft of that era coming in to supply Berlin. Flying boats, the four-engine Dobbs, definitely the old twin-engine Dakotas, and they're all coming in to one of three different airports. The American one at...
Doesn't matter.
No, can't remember their names offhand, but they're well known anyway. Tempelhof Airport, our own at Gatow, and another one, a French one that the name escapes me. But
did the Germans seem grateful?
I think they were grateful for the effort that was being put in. Otherwise, they would have been in very, very dire straits. I think Berlin was there for the taking, and there were, I don't think there was a lot we could have done about it, quite honestly. The garrison in Berlin was there, but that would have been swamped by the Russians if they'd have attacked us. I don't think we would have lasted very long, no matter how determined a resistance we would have put up, unless there was something bigger in that we don't know of.
Let's jump again to 54 and Malaya and in the emergency. Can you tell me of your experiences?
Yes. Now, Malaya was, first of all, because Malaya is a very, very much a jungle-covered country, I personally had a fair idea of what we might be walking into because of the experiences in Burma. So it didn't come as any great surprise to me when I saw the jungles.
Where were you based?
We landed obviously in Singapore, and my first base, to take you right into the story itself, was in a place called a little village called Bahau, A Company of the Queens. That's the first Queens by then. We'd moved into Bahau, we set up a company camp astride the main sewerage ditch that ran right the way through the middle of our camp, which was, to say unpleasant, was to say the least, because it was open. It was a sort of a concrete ditch, but this was what this was their system of drainage. And all the sewer and the muck and everything just flowed through this ditch and hopefully was washed away when it rained, which it did quite often. And it was a tented camp with sort of bivouac-type tents, half a dozen men in a tent, some bigger EPI tents for ourselves. Toilet arrangements were very basic. We had to dig holes into the ground using hand-operated augers to get deep enough down, erect canvas screens or portable little sheds over the loo to call them something like a loo, and the risks of picking up dysentery or diarrhoea consequently was rather rife. It did happen. I fell victim to it for a start. The operations themselves, I was the company sergeant major of A Company then, and but it basically came down to a more junior NCO and junior officer operation. The company, although we were there in Bahel, our three platoons were very well dispersed out into the rubber estates, where they were responsible for keeping an eye on the rubber tappers when they went out to do the tapping of the rubber trees and to make sure there was no interference from the CTs, which is the abbreviation for communist terrorists, while that was going on. Or, in reverse, that the rubber tappers were not taking food and giving it to these people on the fringes of the rubber and the jungle. So that basically was the operations at that particular time.
Which part of Malaya is this?
This was in the state of Johor, where we were at that time. And Johor, of course, is a fairly big area of Malaya, southern Johor, in Johor, south part of Malaya. As you cross the causeway, you come into Johor Bahru, which is the little town, and then you moved into the state of Johor, which was quite an area.
How successful were the operations?
the operations, they were tedious and went for long spells without any results whatsoever. Despite all the patrolling and all the checking of the rubber tappers and the interference one way or the other, results were not forthcoming too quickly. But I will recount or recall that whilst I was at Bahel, we were sitting in the company office tent when a message came through, and on receiving that message there was great jubilation because it came over as that six terrorists had been killed, ambushed and killed, only to be followed very, very soon afterwards a correction in the message, and it wasn't the terrorists, it was our own chaps, had been ambushed and killed by our own people, by mistaken identity, and because one patrol or the other was in the wrong area when they shouldn't have been. And under the circumstances, you didn't ask questions, you shot first and asked questions afterwards. So it was a very sad event where I forget how many men were lost, but it wasn't very good. But that was in the early days of the Malayan exercise, and I was very, very fortunate because within a short space of time, whilst I was at Bahel, I was told that I was to move to Headquarters Malaya Command and take up the appointment as RQMS of that headquarters. So my quarters, I was able to get a quarter up in Kuala Lumpur, very near the headquarters of Malaya Command. And therefore, I and my wife and young children lived a rather more civilised life than the rest of my battalion did for the next 18 months to 2 years.
So I was there. You never went into the jungle yourself?
Oh, yes, I did some jungle. Whilst I was at Bahel, I did some jungle bashing with them.
What was it like?
Well, I personally detest this jungle. And I think also, if anybody ever tells you or tells anyone that they like being in the jungle, I don't think you ought to believe them, quite honestly. I think they're talking sheer bravado. But this Malayan jungle was swampy, steamy, thick, dense, and not very palatable at all. I certainly would not say that I enjoyed my stay in that jungle. I did one or two patrols with the company commander and the other platoons, purely on a search and find sort of patrol information to see if we could come across anything. During my time, that didn't happen. They were, like many patrols, they were unproductive. You put in hours and hours and hours of work on patrolling with no visible results at all.
What did you dislike most about the jungle?
I just disliked it in general, quite honestly. I just ruddy hated the damn place. You were forever wet. You woke up in the morning after trying to get a night's sleep. You were either covered in leeches, you were bitten by something, you were sodden wet. And one used to try and change at night so that when you got up in the morning, you put on a fresh set of clothing, but that was still wet. So can you imagine getting in and putting on wet trousers, wet socks and wet everything from the wet stuff that you're trying to take off? It wasn't very much of a change, quite honestly. Very uncomfortable, quite honestly.
Didn't like life?
I don't know. Snakes were about a bit, like you, one will find in the jungle. I don't remember seeing anything terribly... outrageous. Insects, well, there's always the leeches, isn't there? There's always the mosquitoes to cope with, which are the unpleasant side of the insect life. Can't remember any other form of life, but it was there, particularly at night. The jungle comes alive at night. During the daytime, you wouldn't think there's anything there. Come nighttime and everything quietens down, then everything, the insect life and the bird life does come to life.
Was it a frightening place?
I don't know. I mean, we'd been jungle trained, haven't we? People like myself had experience in the jungle from Burma, so we didn't. Having become accustomed to jungle life, it wasn't frightening. In that sense, but it was, I don't know, I find it difficult to describe how it really does affect one. Not a good outcome.